All right. So thanks, Sid, for the nice introduction. You made my work a lot easier. So today I'm going to continue the theme of talking about experimental probes of the interesting topological features of Weyl and Dirac semimetals. And as we heard in the previous talks, there's been a flurry of discovery of Weyl, and Dirac kind of 3D relativistic semimetals. And these were originally proposed to arise in the pyrochlore iridates, which I guess is the reason I'm giving this talk in an interacting spin orbit session. But actually, in reality, all the materials where they've been actually discovered are rather weakly correlated semiconductor-like materials, and so I will ignore interactions throughout my talk. And there are two kind of classes of materials that we're interested in. One are these Weyl semimetals, where we have individual kind of Weyl points that are not doubled. And this kind of Dirac semimetals, which you can picture, as Sid mentioned, as doubled Weyl semimetals of opposite chirality, but protected from mixing by some crystal symmetry. And as a theorist, the reason we're interested in these materials is that they give you a new example of new kinds of topology that can arise actually without a band gap. So normally we think of topological effects as arising from some protection by a gap, but actually if you have a band touching, you can get new topological features, say singularities in Berry fluxes, that can only arise in a gapless system. And the Weyl node is a particularly good example of this, because it serves as a monopole source of churn flux. And there are two main consequences that have grabbed people's attention, which we've heard a lot about in the previous talk, so I'll just mention them briefly. The first is that if you apply electric and magnetic fields, you end up with this charge pumping from between opposite chirality Weyl nodes, and this is mediated by a very special Landau level, which is near the Weyl node. The lowest Landau level is independent of magnetic field. Its energies are independent of magnetic field, and it disperses exactly along or against the magnetic field. And this serves as the channel which mediates this chiral pumping between valleys. And another manifestation of this topology, so like any good topological material, Weyl semimetals have surface states. And as Sid nicely explained, this. If you take a surface that the two Weyl nodes don't project onto the same point in the surface brilliant zone, there's some kind of imprint of the Dirac string connecting these two Weyl nodes, which is a line of chiral modes that form kind of half of a Fermi surface. And this is, again, something that can only happen in a gapless system, because in order to have, in a gap system, any surface state, there's a nice dividing line between occupied and unoccupied states in the surface brilliant zone. And so in that case, the Fermi surface of the surface state has to be a closed surface and not an open arc. And so this open arc really relies on some direct tight connection to these bulk gap closings. And so the key players in this whole story about the topology of Weyl semimetals are this chiral bulk Landau level and the surface Fermi arcs. And today I want to talk about an experimental probe which can reveal both of these features in a precise way, which is to look at quantum oscillations associated with this Fermi arc surface states after applying a magnetic field. And the goal will be to come up with a way to measure these Fermi arcs surface states and to reveal their topology in a more precise way than is available in ARPES, which gives you a nice picture of these surface states. But it's hard to look at, you know, what's happening here. Are they really forming a closed surface state? Are they meeting some bulk Fermi pocket? Or are they just some kind of conventional surface orbits? And so I want to start with outlining some theory about what happens when you turn on a magnetic field in a Weyl semimetal. And in the second half of the talk, I'll discuss a little bit of some experimental measurements by James Analaisis' group and MIT. So the theory part was done in collaboration with Itamar, who I believe is in the audience, and he'll be a postdoc at MIT starting very soon, and also Ashwin. So just as a reminder, I'm sure everyone in the audience is familiar with this, but quantum oscillations by applying a magnetic field is sort of a classic way of getting a precision measurement of a Fermi surface. And the main idea is that when you apply a magnetic field, semi-classically, electrons just orbit equipotential lines of your Fermi surface. And if you look at quantized versions of these magnetic orbits, they pass through the Fermi level in a periodic pattern and when plotted against one over the magnetic field. And the period of these oscillations tells you about the extremal orbits of your Fermi surface. And by changing the angle, you can get very high precision data about the shape and structure of your Fermi surface. And these blips show up in anything that's sensitive to the density of states, so magnetization. I'll be talking mostly today about conductivity, but also they show up in tunneling density of states and most physical probes. So if we want to apply this kind of measurement to a Weyl semi-metal, we immediately face a conundrum, which is that if I start an electron in this surface Fermi arc, and I turn on a magnetic field, the electron will slide via the Lorentz force towards the end of the arc. But at the end of the arc, where does the electron go? So as we slide towards the end of the arc, we notice that actually the bulk band gap is coming crashing down. And so this single little band picture that we usually think of with semi-classical orbits is breaking down. And you can show that what happens is actually the electron gets shoved into the bulk states. It's the only place for it to go. So once in the bulk, what happens? So it's easiest to think at very low energies, the only state available is actually this chiral lambda level for the bulk. And this chiral lambda level can act as a kind of one-way moving conveyor belt that drags the electron to the opposite surface, the bottom surface of the sample. And there it finds kind of its missing partner, the rest of this Fermi surface that I've kind of divided and is doing some long distance relationship across the sample. And then so on the bottom surface, we can kind of complete the other half of the orbit in exactly the same manner and get a closed magnetic orbit. And so this will be the source of all the phenomena that I'll talk about. And so I just want to make a couple comments that this is an interesting orbit. It's a closed magnetic orbit on a non-local Fermi surface. And it's some mixture of some semi-classical motion and some quantized chiral lambda level motion. And one bizarre feature of this is that it actually can enclose zero flux relative to the magnetic field. So the real space motion of this can actually be completely parallel to the magnetic field, which is something that won't happen for conventional cyclotron orbits. And the other thing I want to mention is that even though I kind of motivated this orbit at low energies where the bulk chiral lambda level is the only state around, you can easily convince yourself that this orbit occurs at any energy where there's this bulk chiral lambda level. And the reason for this is that if I look at this bulk chiral lambda level, I can't form a closed quantum orbit with just one chirality lambda level. I need both. And the only way they can connect at small fields, because momentum you can think is not quite conserved, but it's roughly conserved up to the inverse magnetic length. And so if the inverse magnetic length is much less than this arc length, the only way they can connect is by sliding along this Fermi arc. And so there's a really topological connection that when I turn on the field, I reveal that this Fermi arc is actually the same state as this chiral lambda level. They're intertwined. So I can get to some actual quantum levels from the semi-classical orbits by using the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization condition, basically demanding that the phase I accumulate around an orbit is an integer multiple of 2 pi. And the phase is just the energy of the orbit times the time, semi-classical time it takes to circumnavigate the orbit. And here, the time has two components. One is how long it takes to slide along the arc, which is the arc distance divided by Lorentz force. And the other is how long it takes for me to kind of tunnel or propagate on this chiral lambda level through the bulk, which is just the thickness divided by the bulk velocity. And we can see two regimes. The first is at weak magnetic field, we can ignore this bulk component. And these energy levels look a lot like a conventional 2D Fermi surface. And there we expect quantum oscillations. And you can find that actually the magnetic fields at which these levels cross the Fermi surface is initially regularly spaced. And the frequency of these oscillations, which has the units of a area in momentum space, can be interpreted as follows. So if I start with zero doping, so I start right at this bulk Weyl node with my chemical potential, I'll just have a bulk Fermi surface, it will just be a point, and I'll have these arcs connecting it, the solid line on the top surface and say the dashed on the bottom. Now if I dope to a finite density, these bulk points become little pockets, and the arcs move outwards and connect them tangentially. And the relevant area is actually the area that I sweep out in going from this zero doping arc to this other one, minus whatever's missing in the middle. So that sets this quantum oscillation frequency. And at larger fields, so namely when the field becomes much larger than the arc length over the thickness of my sample, you can basically ignore the arc part of the orbit, and the orbit is roughly just the electron bouncing these finite size levels, bouncing back and forth across the sample, and I get no longer a periodic structure with magnetic fields, so the quantum oscillations cease. So these quantum oscillations and their kind of characteristic thickness dependence give me an experimental signature of this bulk boundary correspondence in this material, and the fact that the surface arcs are topologically tied to this bulk chiral lambda level. And you can reveal it in various ways. One simple, at least as a theorist way, is to imagine just changing the magnetic field orientation and tracking the position of these peaks in the density of states. And you see that there's a part that depends on the angle of the field, but actually the thickness-dependent part will not depend on the field. And so this thickness-dependent kind of offset of the phase of these quantum oscillations, if you can track it precisely, in principle reveals the fact that you have this orbit that goes through the bulk. So it's kind of like a way to measure the topology of these orbits. And so one thing, as we move towards the kind of experimental part of the discussion, is that one important practical consideration always in quantum oscillation measurements is disorder. And in particular, you need to be able to complete the orbit without substantial scattering that will dephase the orbit if you want to get coherent quantum signatures out of this. So fortunately, in a lot of these Dirac materials, the mean free paths can be actually very long, and the scattering times, be it quantum or transport times, are very long. And I'll say a bit more about this once we get to the experimental part. And yeah, just to kind of recap something Sid was mentioning, is that a related measurement is to look at cyclotron resonances associated with these orbits. It's basically the same story, but here if I drive in a field with some kind of electromagnetic wave, the electric field can kind of resonantly drive these orbits if you choose the right frequency. And the cyclotron frequency will also saturate at large fields, and this saturation frequency is dependent on the thickness of your sample. And moreover, you can see that there's a polarization dependence. If I drive perpendicular to the arc, the electrons on the arc can absorb energy from the field if the electric field is along their velocity. But if I put the electric polarization this way, they won't absorb very much energy, so there should be a characteristic polarization versus arc orientation dependence. Yeah, and as Sid kind of tantalizingly mentioned, there's a cute trick of making a very surface-sensitive probe out of this, which I guess you'll have to ask him about. All right. So with this kind of simple semi-classical theory of these Fermi arc quantum oscillations in hand, I want to turn to some recent data measured in James Analytis' group, and the postdoc really championing this measurements is Philip Moll, who will be moving to faculty position in the MPI in Dresden in October. So they developed this really cool way to make microstructures out of cadmium arsenide. And this picture is a bit hard and has some optical illusion-like elements to it, so let me walk you through it. So what they do is they start with a thin film of cadmium arsenide, and they take a focused ion beam, and they can basically carve out sections that they don't want. And so these dark shaded sections are pieces that they've carved out with a focused ion beam. And you can see that they leave in these holes a thin film of cadmium arsenide kind of standing on its side compared to the pictures I've been drawing so far. So these little purple sheets are thin films standing on their side. And they can control the thickness of this kind of freestanding membrane piece and also its geometry just by changing kind of the angles of the fabrication, the ion beam milling So the nice thing about this fabrication technique is that the ions are incident from the top. So they're actually come in at grazing incidents to the surface. So they have the effect of actually cleaning off the surface as they come down, because any kind of junk sticking out will get blasted off. So they get very nice surfaces on these side surfaces. The top surface is junk, but in the way they've fabricated it, this is not the important surface for surface states. And the other nice thing is that both surfaces have basically the same fabrication parameters, and so they'll be roughly the same. Okay, so if they, so the measurement they do is to run current through these devices in a field. And so let me start with the field. You can orient the field in any angle you like. And if the field is perpendicular to the surface, so that's 0 degrees, you see this large transverse magnetoresistance is characteristic of these materials, and on top of it some quantum oscillations, which if you analyze, you see two frequencies, say this first peak and the second peak, which has some weird stretched line shape. And if I turn the field parallel to the surface, I only see one frequency. So these little double peaks here are actually spin splitting of the bulk Fermi surface. But if I Fourier transform, I can see really clearly see just one bulk, or one frequency. And moreover, as I change the angle of the field continuously, I can watch what happens to these two peaks. And this one that I'm calling FS has some characteristic 1 over cosine theta dependence, which clearly marks it as a surface state. And the bulk, this blue peak, is actually a bulk pocket that's roughly symmetric. And so this is really characteristic, or suggestively depicted in this polar plot, where here it's an angle. It's a polar plot of the frequency versus angle. So the question is, what's the source of this surface signal? Is it related to those Weil oscillations that I was talking about in the first half of the talk? And to do this, I have to address an elephant in the room, which is related to Youngbeck's question, which is, what are the, so cadmium arsenide is actually a Dirac semimetal, it's not a Weil semimetal. So what is the role of this crystal symmetry requirements on the protection, and how do the surface states of one of these Dirac semimetals look? So naively, if we picture the Dirac semimetal as two copies of Weil semimetal protected by crystal symmetry, you expect two sets of arcs. One from the one kind of crystal symmetry representation and one from the other, dispersing the opposite way. And generically, they'll meet at the bulk Dirac point. The problem is that the crystal symmetry protecting the bulk nodes is actually some rotation symmetry along the axis separating them. So any surface that you expect to see these arcs actually doesn't preserve this symmetry. So you might think that this is immediately game over for these arcs and that they'll reconstruct into some kind of more conventional looking surface state. But the situation is actually a bit more subtle. So as the arcs approach the bulk where they come close to each other, they're actually retreating into the bulk of the sample. And so this crystal symmetry breaking, which is only active at the surface, is becoming less and less effective. And so actually this corner feature that I've drawn here exists over some finite range of surface parameters. And if the surface symmetry breaking is sufficiently strong, but there's some finite strength required, it can reconstruct into this kind of surface state. But as she was mentioning, there's an important topological constraint on the existence of surface states. And you can roughly think of it as the way we get this Dirac semimetals by inverting some S and P bands. And they'll cross in some ring. And since it's a spin orbit coupled system, this ring will be lifted almost everywhere except due to this axial rotation symmetry, which keeps two points here. But up to this last part of the sentence, everything I told you is a recipe for a topological insulator. And you can convince yourself that actually the topological invariant that you get by this band inversion is not affected by just having some extra gapless points on the edge. So that there actually will be a topological insulator kind of surface state. And the thing is that it may or may not intersect the nodes, but when it does, it kind of sticks to the bulk Dirac nodes over some finite range of parameters. And additionally, you can see that if you start with this TI-like surface termination and dope, eventually the TI surface will run into the bulk Fermi pockets, and I'll get this arc kind of termination instead. So it's very relevant to think about Fermi arcs in this system. So there are basically three possible origins for this surface state. The one is this arc-like termination, where the surface states run into the bulk pockets and not into each other. And there we would expect some Weil-like quantum oscillations. Another possibility is this just having an ordinary 2D, well, almost ordinary, but helical TI-like surface state. And the last is that if the chemical potential is, say, up above this Dirac region, then the origin of the surface state would have to be something conventional and non-topological, say, from band bending at the surface. So one suggestion against this third is that we see these surface oscillations on many different crystallographic orientations in many different samples. So it suggests some kind of robustness to this quantum oscillations. So I'll focus on kind of distinguishing between these two states in the orbits. So the first gross thing you expect is that if I make the device too thick, the surface oscillation should go away. And indeed it does. So they can fabricate devices of various thicknesses. And the surface component of the oscillation here in this FFT plot, you can see it dying pretty quickly. And it fits reasonably well to some exponential with some characteristic length scale of, say, 600 nanometers. So theoretically, we expect that any kind of quantum oscillation phenomena is suppressed by some Dingle factor, which is basically inversely proportional to the cyclotron frequency times the scattering time. And so here, the effective cyclotron frequency times scattering time is basically the time it takes to complete the orbit and the scattering time for each segment. So there's two pieces. The first is this bulk part, this bulk part, which depends on the thickness, and the surface part where you're sliding along the arc. And importantly here, there's some subtlety of what's the correct scattering time to phase the quantum oscillations. And on the surface and in conventional oscillations, it's actually just the full scattering rate. Every scattering process, it dephases you. In the bulk, it's a bit more subtle because you're kind of riding on this chiral lambda level. And this chiral lambda level doesn't turn around for anything. So it can just ride straight through disorder. So the time it takes to go through the bulk, if I'm sticking on this chiral lambda level, is independent of what the impurity potential. So the only thing that can scatter me in the bulk is if I can turn around to some non-chiral state. And that, in the regime where I'm seeing bulk quantum oscillations, requires some sizable momentum transfer. So this bulk scattering time we expect to be more like a transport scattering time, which in these materials is much longer. And in fact, we can extract the transport lifetime by looking at some finite size effects in the magnetic field. So if we apply the magnetic field not perpendicular to the surface, but parallel to the surface, the bulk orbits, if the cyclotron radius is small, they just go like this. But if the cyclotron radius is big, at weak fields, they'll kind of hit the edge before they complete a cyclotron orbit. And right at the point where the cyclotron orbit is kind of half as big as the, or twice as big as the sample, you get maximal kind of backscattering from this effect. And you can see an enhancement, which just depends on thickness of the resistance, just the smooth background. And by fitting this, you can extract that there's a transport mean free path of roughly 1.2 microns, which is in good agreement to actually twice this characteristic decay scale. And the twice comes from the fact that you have to traverse the bulk twice in order to complete this orbit. So one caveat is that there's some subtlety here, which is that you're looking at two terminal resistance here. And so really bulk and surface are kind of intermingled. And so we want to distinguish this kind of thickness dependence with some trivial kind of geometric factor of the bulk just shorting out the surface. So you can try to, decay fits slightly less well to this kind of power loss and thickness decay that suggests like this, but this is really kind of a quantitative distinction. So can we do something qualitative? This is where Philip had a really cool idea, which is to look at not a rectangular device where both surfaces are parallel, but a triangular device where there's some angle between the two surfaces. And now if I apply a magnetic field, kind of effective thickness depends on my position along this triangle. And if you recall back to the first part of my talk, the frequency of these quantum oscillations doesn't depend on the thickness of my sample, but the phase of them does. And so this is a lot like having a Josephson junction in a magnetic field, where the orbits from different parts of these samples have different phases and they all are expected to wash out and kill each other. Whereas if I have parallel surfaces, they add up coherently and give me these quantum oscillations. And indeed, you can see that if you look at this triangular device, these nice bulk oscillations, and the surface one is just completely gone. And importantly, this triangle device was fabricated to have the same surface bulk ratio as this rectangle device within, say, 10%. And so this is not a trivial, like, different surface to bulk volume ratio effect. And also, the way this triangle device was not made by kind of rastering the focus ion beam around to curve deeper and deeper as I go this way. Rather, they tilted the sample with respect to the ion beam. So the ions were always coming in at grazing incidence to every surface on this triangle, all three of them. And so we expect the cleanliness of this triangular surface to be similar to the rectangular one. And so this is really suggestive of this arc-like termination, because it relies on some kind of phase coherence of the thickness of my sample. And another kind of more detailed effect that we expect of these kind of non-local Fermi arc-like quantum oscillations is that as the electron slides along the surface arc, it doesn't actually reach the end of the arc before it jumps into the bulk. But if you look at kind of non-adiabatic corrections to this semi-classical picture, you find that the electron actually jumps into the bulk when it reaches, say, an inverse magnetic length of the surface. So actually, the arc length that you have to slide across depends on field and becomes shorter and shorter as you go to stronger and stronger fields. And what this means is that actually the position of these peaks is not regularly spaced with Landau level index, but kind of slides down as you go to larger Landau level index. And here you can see that the measured agrees reasonably well with this non-adiabatic correction, where this coefficient is, say, roughly of order 1. This 4 is because you have four of these as you go around. And what it turns into if you Fourier transform this is that the line shape for the surface peak, so this is a theoretical calculation, gets kind of smushed over towards low frequencies. So it's not a sharp Lorentzian line shape like you would expect from normal quantum oscillations, but this very asymmetric peak. And indeed, that's what they see in the data. And it agrees remarkably well with this kind of shape you expect here. And I want to comment that you can also get strange line shapes from, say, precursors to spin splitting, say, if this were a conventional or topological insulator-like surface. But actually, these have the wrong sign of correction. Those would bend up in this plot. And they would also, the magnitude is unphysically large. It would require some huge G factor that's kind of several hundred. And also, it wouldn't produce this kind of sharply asymmetric line shape, because you would roughly have the two frequencies, one for the spin up and one for the spin down, that kind of pull the peak apart as you go to higher fields. So that would be a more symmetric broadening. All right, so through a lot of information, so let me just summarize what's seen and what's not seen in these cadmium arsenide microstructures relative to what we expect. So we see this surface component of the quantum oscillations only in thin films, which is consistent with these kind of orbits that require going through the bulk. And there's some reasonable agreements with the theoretical dependence on disorder and what's observed. Maybe a more interesting observation is that the oscillations seem to require parallel surfaces. So having surfaces that are at an angle with each other kill the oscillations, which is consistent with the phase being dependent on the length of the bulk. Another thing, if you remember, we predicted that if you go to too large of fields, there's a field at which the quantum oscillations stop. So this is actually not observed over the field range that's accessible right now. And if you do kind of back of the envelope estimate, you expect these saturation fields to be few Tesla. So it's a little troublesome, but it's possible that they're kind of lurking just beyond the field range probed. But this is something, you know, that needs further study. And there's also clearly a surface state based on the angle dependence. And in the first part of my talk, I mentioned that if you look carefully at the angle dependence of these peaks, you can actually back off the fact that there's a thickness-dependent piece. It's kind of like a way to measure this topological connection of surface and bulk. So unfortunately, doing this is kind of complicated in this setup. And the reason is, well, there's several reasons. The first is that the surface and the bulk contributions come at very similar frequencies. So in the real space positions of these peaks are kind of all on top of each other. So, and the other thing is that this line shape of the surface component kind of bleeds into the bulk. So it's hard to kind of disentangle them. So we were unable to cleanly distinguish them at this point. So basically, the error bars in the position of the peak is larger than their separations. Okay, so maybe let me just skip this summary slide and finish with just a brief advertisement. So far I've been talking about magnetic signatures of this topological features in this in while interact semi-metals. But there is also high field measurements provide a simple kind of way to diagnose a while semi-metal. And the reason is that, so here I'm looking at torque magnetometry measurements, which is basically a measurement of magnetization, or rather magnetization anisotropy. And while electrons are kind of special in that you have this lowest chiral Landau level. And so as I crank up the field, if I start with some finite doping, all the states are increasingly piled into this lowest Landau level. So the energy of the conduction states are actually decreasing as I crank up the magnetic field, which gives me a paramagnetic response to magnetic field. And once I'm in this quantum limit, the energy stops depending on field, because this lowest Landau level doesn't depend on field. And then what's left is any residual diamagnetism from these valence bands or from some of these materials that have kind of conduction, massive conduction pockets also. So what you would expect in torque for the while semi-metal is a big reversal in torque. First, you kind of have this paramagnetic thing, and then when you reach the quantum limit, it kind of turns around and you just get some diamagnetism from the background. Whereas for conventional electrons, you expect it to kind of go up and maybe dressed by some quantum oscillations and just get diamagnetism the whole way. And indeed, if you measure these in niobium and marcenide, which is one of these Weyl candidates, you see exactly this kind of torque reversal. So this may be a simple symptom to diagnose a Weyl semi-metal. All right, so thanks a lot for your attention.
Questions? Bruce?
This might not be completely fair, might be more appropriate for your experimental colleagues, but a couple of times you mentioned how clean the surfaces were from the focused ion beam. And I was wondering a couple of things. One is how was that quantified? And secondly, kind of what's at stake? How sensitive are these sorts of effects to weak disorder that's almost certainly at the surface, even despite these efforts?
Right. So I have a kind of indirect answer, which is that since you're seeing some surface component of the quantum oscillations, you know that at least the portion of the orbit that's on the surface is clean enough that you can complete it without scattering. And so since you see these nice clean quantum oscillations, that's indicative of having a very clean surface. It's hard to extract, say, what's exactly the transport, what mean free path of the surface since the bulk is also conducting. But I think there's a really good sign that the surfaces are morally clean in the sense that cyclotron frequency times the scattering rate is large at a few tesla.
I was curious if your collaborators had done some sort of characterization of the surfaces otherwise.
Yeah, I believe they have, but I can't speak to the details. I mean, they know how thick the ion implantation layers are and things like that. So,
thank you.
I have a question. So I'm having a bit of a difficulty really understanding when you tilt the field, how does this bulk transport work? Because it seems that once you tilt the field, in real space, the electron moves at an angle, right?
Yeah, precisely.
So does that affect the outcome in any way?
Yeah, so the chiral Landau level goes along the magnetic field, just as you say. And so if I tilt the field relative to the surface, it has to go further through the bulk. And so actually you expect the scattering to become more and more detrimental the longer you make this orbit. And indeed, actually, they see that as they tilt the surface, the amplitude, the magnetic field, the amplitude of the surface oscillation dies pretty quickly. So it's only observable within some, 30 degrees of the top surface. So it's kind of consistent with what you expect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions, Leon?
Just to get a clarification, what determines the frequency of the surface component of the oscillation? You said something like if you're right at the wild point in the bulk, is there a...
So it's always arc length over, the frequency in the magnetic field?
Yeah, in the magnetic field, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically the area difference between the zero doping and whatever doping you're at of this arc length.
What happens at zero doping then?
Yeah, so at zero doping, everything's particle hole symmetric. So as you adjust the magnetic field, the lambda levels move away from the chemical potential, and they never cross the chemical potential. And so you won't see these quantum oscillations. You still have these orbits, but they're just moving away from here symmetrically in a particle hole symmetric fashion. So you need levels to keep crossing your chemical potential to see these quantum oscillations.
Okay.
So you need some finite doping, actually.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
In Dirac semimetals with Fermi arcs, there are two closed orbits that can form. One is only on the surface, the other one goes through the bulk.
Yeah.
So do you understand which will give rise to stronger quantum oscillations?
Which will give rise to stronger? So that's dependent on probably many details. Like I would assume that the surface only has a shorter orbit, so there's less chance to scatter. That sounds a bit more robust to disorder, but.
On the surface, there's a kink where the two Fermi arcs connect, so it's hard to scatter from one to the other two. So
are you asking if you have this arc-like termination? So there's two possible terminations, right? One is where you have arcs, and one is where you have like a TI surface.
Yeah, so if you have a Dirac semi-metal.
Yeah. This is for Dirac, yeah.
So then there are two Fermi arcs on each surface.
Mm-hmm.
And where they connect, there is generically there is a kink. It's not a smooth connection.
Mm.
So it's hard to hop from one Fermi arc to the other on the surface, and it's also hard to go through the bulk. So I was just wondering which process.
Sorry, I don't understand why is it hard to go through the bulk?
Well, because there's the thickness. As the film gets thicker and thicker, it's harder to go through it. That's it.
But it's not harder to go into it, right? You just, if it's thicker, you may scatter before you get all the way through, but you always go into the bulk.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It's harder to go all the way through for thickers.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can discuss after. I feel like I'm missing something important.
Right.
Yeah, so I want to follow up on that point there. You know, when you look at the two, this is in the Dirac semi-metal, when you have the two arcs,
mm-hmm.
So it's like the plus and minus of one arc will then can have to go through the bulk and come back. So. And then the negative and positive of the other one will make an opposite channel of circulation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you'll go from one arc to the other arc on the surface, I think.
Right. You have two separate copies of this Weil orbit in the ideal situation that don't talk to each other, basically.
Right. So you'll have like two
from
surface to bulk back circulating
mm-hmm.
one way, and the other arc will be circulating the other way.
Yes, precisely.
Right. So it will never go from one arc to the other arc on the surface.
Yeah.
Is what I wanted to say.
Yes. Thank you.
So if the Weil system is has finite doping, so the bulk you have a bulk Fermi surface as well, right? So then once you're considering this quantum oscillation of the arc, that the electron will go from firstly, on the surface on the arc, then they will go to the. It's possible for this electron to go to the bulk Fermi surface. Then it's circling around the bulk Fermi surface, but it can circle for many times before it runs into the other surface.
Yeah, so I don't think this actually happens. So
yeah.
There's some topological connection between this bulk chiral lambda level and the surface arc, and the surface doesn't go into these non-chiral lambda levels, it goes straight into the bulk one.
Right.
So unless you scatter this process where you kind of circle many times.
So the point is, so if it circles many times, it's very difficult to estimate how much time is spent on this circling on the bulk Fermi surface.
But as I said, unless you have impurity scattering, this won't occur.
Uh-huh.
You'll go straight through into this chiral mode instead.
Okay, if there's no more questions. Oh, there's one question in the back.
So it kind of seemed like it was important to be able to follow the orbit of the, so you are along the arc and then you go through the bulk. So in the bulk, are the bands would be less well defined than they are at the surface, right?
In what sense? I mean.
Well, so at the surface, I mean, it's kind of a naive picture, but you have the well defined states, your linear dispersing states. And then, at least in the pictures that you and Sid drew, you were following your surface state, which then went into the bulk and then back up into the other vial point. So when you're inside this, where you're inside, you know, together with the other bands, can you really say that you're keeping on that same band?
Yeah, this is this kind of topological argument that I gave, so that the bulk chiral lambda level has to be able to turn around, and the only way it can do this is through this surface arc. And so they're actually turned into this state when you turn on a magnetic field. And so you really have some well-defined connection between the surface arc and the bulk chiral lambda level, not the non-chiral ones. Yeah, it's related to Chi's question. Mm-hmm. But so the bulk bands are well-defined in the clean. Okay, under ideal conditions in the clean case, or clean enough to see bulk quantum oscillations, you have these nice separate bulk lambda levels, and they're very well defined. And mm-hmm. just the chiral one connects to the surface states. The other ones can turn around just by scattering off the surface on their own. Actually see exactly this if you just put this problem on a computer and find the exact eigenstates. So this semi-classics picture I gave was just the simplest way to understand it, but you can also confirm just directly numerically that this occurs.
Even with weak interactions, I guess, is what
Interactions are probably not very important at low temperatures because the scattering rate for these electrons will go down as some kind of T squared if you have some doping. So if you cool enough, I think you can, and these are weakly correlated materials, so I think you can probably ignore dephasing from interactions.
Okay, I think we have exhausted all the questions, so let's thank the speaker again. And we will reconvene here at 11 for the remainder of this session.